Beware, spoiler phobes. You have stumbled upon A Storm of Spoilers, a podcast about HBO's Game of Thrones series in conjunction with the Song of Ice and Fire books by George R.R. Martin. This discussion can expand to include any Game of Thrones relevant books, shows, internet extras, special features, teases, trailers, interviews, rumors, guesses, theories, and general crackpotitude. We're not ruining, we're enriching. After all, chaos isn't a pit, it's a ladder. You do not wish to be spoiled or are not caught up. Please stop now.
The realm. Do you know what the realm is? It's the thousand blades of Aegon's enemies. A story we agree to tell each other over and over till we forget that it's a lie. But what do we have left? Gaping pit waiting to swallow us all. Chaos isn't a pit. Chaos is a ladder.
Hello and welcome to A Storm of Spoilers, where we all keep our oaths. Ha 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 ha. Well, no, the important thing is that my name is Dave Gonzalez, and I have not read any of the books in George R.R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and I've read every book in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And I am Neil Miller, and I have read everything.
Oh, nice.
Ever in the history of the world?
All of the things in the history of the world.
Oh, that's so much. Okay.
Yes.
That's going to be pretty
including
sweet.
Including lots of message board theories about Game of Thrones.
Right.
That's good.
And I know, I'm sorry, not to like step on your marvelous intro, Dave. Never mind.
No, go ahead. Later. No, you want to, we could talk about, we got to burn like 2 minutes because this goes into a feed for people that may not like spoilers, so I don't like to start off with like the, oh, hey, here's who died this week.
That's true. I just want to say that it's so unusual to do this podcast with you, Dave, and now you, Neil, because I actually feel like you both know more than I do, and that makes me feel uncomfortable. No, it makes me feel fine, but
how is that even possible?
Well, because I don't read every message board. I feel like you're both way more into the wiki stuff than I am, and I try to read a lot of the wiki stuff in the message board, but like Dave, you always like come up with these theories and I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that, like vaguely. Do you know what I mean? Does that make
right
any
and
sense?
Neil's transcended like Johnny Depp, so he just reads everything.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that makes
well
sense.
and fun story, right after this past week's episode, which I'm not going to talk about yet because we're still in the 2 minutes.
Yep.
The Wiki of Ice and Fire, which is the go-to for people who have read the books, was down of like all these book readers scrambling to figure out what it was that they just watched.
I saw that.
Fantastic.
Yeah, Todd Vanderhoof from AV Club like tweeted out. He's like, God, I don't know what to do. The wiki's down. What do I do?
How do I know if I should know this? That was pretty much my question. It's like, should I know this? Did I miss something? Apparently we all missed a lot.
Did I fall asleep during a large section? No? Okay.
This one's going to be a barn burner because we're on the most equal footing we've been on our third episode. And why not burn books to burn that barn? Because we're all ice Nazis. Let's kick it off with the first thing that was different, which I think would be, oh, we're talking with Grey Worm having a sort of conversation because they have to delay Ser Jorah's truth coming out because they want to do it in that gigantic throne room they've built and they want to do it later on during the season. Is that all that was? Or then, actually, you know what? No, that's a horrible way to phrase the question that's completely uninteresting where I just say what I think. Joanna, you have this really interesting theory that this is a reaction to people thinking that Dany's this white savior to all these darker slaves. Can you elaborate on that for me and make me understand?
Do you really not understand, or do you want me to make the podcast listeners understand?
I want you to plead the case that this is the showrunners talking to us, because I think last week showed that I don't even necessarily know what the showrunners are trying to communicate.
I mean, it's just my theory that it's, well, I just think it's convenient storytelling wise that a lot of people were upset by the last shot of last season and all of the Mesa stuff, which is really frustrating to not be able to talk about on a spoiler level, because I want to say that's kind of the point, you know, like she thinks she's a savior and she doesn't quite know what she's getting into, you know, but you can't say, well, everything's going to go pretty shitty for Dany soon, you know, because you can't, right? So I think people are a little misguided with their white savior anger. But my theory is that they had Grey Worm go into the sewers and sort of give him, both him and Miss Endy, that backstory in order to not just put two attractive people in the firelight talking to each other, but also, you know, make it more about the slaves doing it for themselves rather than Danny doing it for them. So,
Neil, how much time are we saving and what have we rearranged by not having, or by having the sort of Jorah showdown? He had to sneak into the last place Khaleesi liberated, not this place. What's the point of reordering that way?
Well, I mean, that whole sequence, by the way, Neil, is told in Joanna. Flashback, so it's not as if, you know, everything we saw, that rousing speech, it's not as if, like, that's Jorah's rousing speech in the book or anything like that. I probably agree with what you say about the throne room, and I also agree that it's a good idea to keep Jorah around as much as possible because he's a great character.
I have an additional thought. Do you also think that it's possible that they are sort of bracing for the loss of Jorah? Because he really does kind of disappear for a while by trying to make us care a little bit more about these other characters around her.
I think that's a very valid point.
To keep her story interesting. Because they do that a lot, where they really do kind of brace for these changes that the rest of us know are coming. So it's like, all right, well, if they lose Jorah at some point during the season, which they have to, you know, what else? Who are we going to really care about? You know, are we going to care about Winky Man or, you know, old guy? Or are we going to care about these, like, two sexy young slaves who are teaching each other languages? The fact that that dude has no testicles.
Perfect. I'm glad you got there without any sort of correction. That's why I need book readers, is to remind me who has their testicles. I mean, this is something that we've seen a lot in Game of Thrones. I guess we're just talking about it more this season, but the especially that's where Joanna and I sort of touched down on why Jaime came back so early to King's Landing. But the idea of, we know we have these very difficult things coming up that are about nuance and are about being in the middle of a very long book series, and maybe television isn't ready to do those things, or maybe, you know, we're kind of, our dog is getting wagged by the tail. Wag the dog. Dog's getting wagged by the tail.
Lots of wagging.
I don't know who's doing it, and it's very confusing. But it seems like we're bracing for Jorah, and that also must be the motivation for everything that's happening in the last 20 minutes of this episode. Because I want to get into this soon, because I want to spend a lot of time here, because I need someone to explain to me when Bran hears things from Old Man. Did HBO spoil the books, and is that even possible? And how many resurrected Starks are we going to see by the end of this HBO series?
How many resurrected Starks is it going to take before you learn this lesson? Okay.
Yeah.
How many Stark heads coming back on their bodies is it going to take? You want to ask those questions right now? I think Neil should answer them.
Yeah, I'm interested in all those pieces, and I think they all might be intertwining to make one whole, but I don't want to step on anybody's... you're almost more informed than I am.
We'll get to your questions in 1 second.
Okay.
I have answers for all of these. I think the other good point there is that there is a point where the show is going to have to start making us care about other characters, because as we look forward, so many more people are going to die this season.
Yes.
That we really do, you know, characters we like, especially if it kind of plays out the way I think it's going to play out. You know, you just kind of have to go down this list of, like, all these characters you like who are not going to make it out of season 4, who don't make it out of book 3. So there's that. So I think that's another big element to introducing a lot of new stuff. I think it's part of why they introduced the Fortress of Solitude, because they're not going to have a whole lot of other stuff to get us to the next kind of phase of the story.
You don't think the King's Moot at the Iron Islands is the most fascinating thing we could possibly enjoy?
It's so fascinating on paper that I think I might have skipped a few chapters and had to go back and reread them. And I think they're condensing that story. It's almost, they would have to at this point. You know, the sister all of a sudden is like a big deal, whereas in the book she's not that big of, well, she's the POV character, but her going after Theon at the end of last year really says, okay, we're changing this.
Right. And Dave and I talked about that last week, and my theory is that she's going to take the place of a Victarion, like, mm-hmm. that they're not going to bring in one of the uncles, and it's going to be Yara right. instead. Right.
Mm. Well, I mean, I want to revisit this when we get to the more supernatural things, because I think this show is also has the danger of turning the corner where it kills off a lot of good characters and then tries to go supernatural and then can't go back to make us care about lesser characters that we haven't, like, hooked into. If that makes a sort of... Like, if all of a sudden Bran's talking to undead people and the walkers are at the wall and we have to go Kingsmoot, like, there might have been a time where the show was capable of having that sort of intertension drama existing at the same time as a White Walker assault, but I don't know if we'll be there if, like, we're supposed to, you know, be looking through Reek's perspective or something.
Yeah, and I think the other thing about the Kingsmoot that they will potentially skip that, but the whole purpose of that, in my mind, in the books, is to get whichever one, is it Victarion that goes after Daenerys? He goes across the Narrow Sea.
Right.
I always forget which one. There's like 700 uncles, so I forget which one it is. So the really the whole point of that is to kind of break that family apart and, like, have one of them go off and say, well, I'm going to go find the Dragon Lady. So I still think that's going to happen. I still think someone's going to go out after Daenerys, whether or not they combine the two uncles into one.
Right. And it's a bunch. And that's sort of what keeps happening, is like a couple different plot lines start bleeding over into Dany's plot line, which is great because she's out isolated from the rest of the show. It's amazing they've been able to sort of keep that up for as long as they have. And I completely agree with you guys about we're going to lose a lot of characters that we're invested in. And I think it was a big sort of risk that George R. R. Martin took. And so to do it to a show watching audience, I think that's why it's smart to sort of try to bleed book four into the season a bit, to make that transition easier. And also, I had a great point, but it's gone anyway. So back to what you were talking about.
Well, and they've also done a lot of good work kind of parsing together stuff that doesn't pan out in the books. Like, the best example I can think of is Robb Stark's wife. So in the books you have, he marries this girl, he makes Walder Frey mad, but then he leaves her at a castle and goes to the wedding and gets killed. In my mind, what they did in the show by bringing her in, not only did they make that relationship more palpable, they also killed off a storyline that is kind of this dangling thread that was hanging over the books until that point. It's like, oh, well, did he have a baby with her? Is there a Stark, you know, child that might get born later? And the show is just like, no, that doesn't matter. We're gonna kill her.
And that ties into what Dave was saying about the show spoiling the books, because a lot of people were mad about that. They're like, oh, we were really into our theory that Jane was off somewhere pregnant because she was plump in one chapter and skinny in the next, and now the show has ruined that for us. And I just think that's pretty silly.
Really what it's saying, the show is telling us, hey, that wasn't going to matter anyway. So
yeah, exactly. It saved George R. R. Martin from having to write a chapter being like, and by the way, she is not pregnant. Your theories are wrong.
Well, did the reverse thing just happen to us this episode? Much larger forward in the books.
And really, that's not even on the show so much as it is on that HBO description thing that happened, which we should explain to listeners who...
Go for it, Joanna. You're on this one. You're on the wavelength.
Okay. Well, this was brought to my attention, like, that same night of the show on Sunday night by Miles McNutt, that the HBO description of the episode named the Darth Maul looking White Walker who comes and changes the baby as the Night's King. And so that's a character in the book, but it's not, you know, it's not obvious if you're just watching the show who that is. So that's actually the HBO description. How that's, like, snuck by, or, I mean, if they had not changed it, and then they took it down like the next day, if they hadn't changed it, then I would just been like, okay, the showrunners were just like, yeah, we introduced this character, so what? But the fact that it was taken down means it was an error that it was put up in the first place. And I'm wondering how that snuck through. You know, I'm surprised. So,
do you think it was a reveal, Neil? Or do you think it was an intern?
Well, I mean, first of all, that would be a really awesome joke. And a really nerdy joke that I think I would appreciate beyond most jokes. Like, if it was some intern who's just like, watch this, I'm going to screw them all up, you know, because they understand how detailed things are. It does make sense, you know, because I think, you know, in the books, one of the things that I've always loved about the books is that a lot of the stories that are told, a lot of the, you know, a lot of the lore that is brought up really does matter later. All those details are there for a reason. And the show does that as well. Like, my theories about, you know, why does Jon Snow keep bringing up his mother? You know, they keep bringing this weird little, like, okay, his mother is like nobody. No, my mother was nobody. Well, okay, now that detail matters to me. So, so I feel like it is a reveal. And I feel like the fact that story was told so early in the books, there is something that's going to come back to it. I don't know if it's going to be as deep. You know, like, sure, the Night King, the Night's King, right? That's what he's called?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure, he could be an old Brandon Stark from way back in the day. But is that going to matter? Or is he going to end up just being a big bad guy? You know, is it going to be like a thing where he eventually meets up and sees a Stark and like stops?
Oh, it's Captain America. Is that what you're saying?
Oh my God, it's you.
That's
it's the
Night
other
King
brand
is
Stark.
Is the Winter Soldier? Okay, sorry.
Yeah. See, that's where I was more thinking, like, the only reason I would be on the side of he's a character that's going to come and make the connection that the book readers are making for the show is because we have a lot of trouble in the show of dealing with history in interesting ways, and this would be a way of figuring out the origins of this supernatural character that I think they'd be able to deal with it that wouldn't just be somebody talking to it. But I think if you were just going to, like, have a undead frozen Stark character, we would have seen Cold Hands. They would have just brought him in and done that.
I still
that
think
with
we're
going
to see him.
I
think we're going to see him soon.
You well, yeah, because the he's keep... the one who kills the mutineers.
Right.
I think that because the biggest change that bothered me in the last episode wasn't this reveal of the White Walkers. I think that's a cool reveal to kind of say, hey, there's this cool stuff. And they're not going to come back to that for a season and a half. We're not going to see those guys again. Like they always do with those characters. But I think the biggest change is putting Bran Stark at Craster's Keep in the, you know, basically right in line with where Jon Snow is going. They don't meet.
Yeah, there's no way those two characters are going to meet. It's going to be another, like, sliding doors situation or whatever, like, where they just
exactly.
miss each other. Yeah.
And there's no way that if they do meet, Jon Snow lets him go off into the wilderness.
Right.
This is not going to happen. So I think Cold Hands comes by soon before Jon Snow gets there.
You don't think Locke, like, knocks him out and just gets Bran out of there?
I don't know.
Otherwise, why that is that character there? Just because that actor is really good and we need someone for Jon Snow to play off of?
Maybe, but I think that would be disappointing if that's the whole reason why he's there, is to replace that kind of Cold Hands idea.
No, because it would have been...
I think Cold Hands is too cool of a character
I mean,
to
he,
pass
he,
up.
Is really cool, but like, if by not having him already miss out helping Sam, we already kind of don't know that the wall is magic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's already like that plot hole is already there, and I can only hope that that was necessary, or that, you know, by the time we get back to needing to know the wall's magic, it'll be like a couple scenes of, you know, I don't know, something disintegrating trying to climb over it, you know, maybe mm-hmm. they'll do it through visual storytelling. But it seems like if Cold Hands ends up being, and this is something I've only read as a possible theory, the Stark we saw right off in season one mm-hmm. and get lost.
That's my favorite theory. And,
well,
and
it's such a good one, too.
And it's been constantly debunked, but I really want it to be Benjen Stark so much.
Yeah, Benjen, thank you. Yeah. So if it's Benjen Stark and the Night's King or whatever is an old Stark, and Lady Stoneheart ends like the end of this, and if Jon ends up getting attacked and having to be resurrected.
A resurrected Targaryen Stark.
Yeah, exactly. Doesn't that just become like it's the Starks get resurrected except for Ned because we liked him?
Well, Ned got his head chopped off. Ned's gone. We just have to live with that.
Hey, Dave, you should pitch your tagline for the next season.
Winter never dies?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just want a poster of Cold Hands on the Elk and King White Walker dude and Lanny Stoneheart all in like badass superhero, like basically the Captain America 2 poster with those characters, and it says Winter Never Dies.
I would love to see Michelle Fairley in the Scarlett Johansson pose. Like arms
with a
out.
Huge scar on her neck and
or Winter still coming.
Still
no,
coming.
Really.
No.
No, no, really. Still
you
coming.
Can't stop Winter. Okay, mine's the worst.
Probably still coming this time.
Yeah. Well, this goes back to that piece that I wrote that you referred to. I also think that the whole reason we're having John go out to Craster's Keep is to paint him as a more heroic, better leader. So mm-hmm. I actually think he's going to kill Locke. I think that's what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Just so that we can get more John badass, because the battle is not happening until episode 9. So we have until episode mm-hmm. 9 to establish John as our convincing leader, have the battle happen in episode 9, and then episode 10.
You don't think that's going to happen until episode 9?
I know for a fact. Sorry. Oh. Do you not want me to like spoil show stuff for you?
No, that's sorry. Fine. I've been trying to pry it out of my people that I know that work at HBO for weeks.
Well, Neil Marshall's directing it, and it's called
yeah, that's true.
It's called like Watchers on the Wall. Mm-hmm. I think.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think the Battle of Castle Black is episode 9. It's their second Blackwater, they hope.
Right. Well, and that gives them enough time for like Stannis to get there.
Right,
and all that crap.
And then yeah, if you look at I've been just reading way too much into the episode titles. And so I think I think the one before that is the Viper in the Mountain or something like that. So that's what we're going to see in episode 8. The one before that is Mockingbird. So it's some Littlefinger stuff, I guess. But I don't think he's going to throw Lysa out the moon door until episode 10. I think that's happening. The moon door shit is happening at the end of the season.
Well, where do you think the Tyrion Tywin thing comes in?
Oh, episode 10.
Yeah.
And then,
you think that's
and then Tyrion
right
like
the
scampering off into the distance. Right. Yeah. And then we end with Lady Stoneheart. That's what I want.
I am so into the ending with Lady Stoneheart thing. You have no idea. It makes so much sense. And I think you have this like Pod and Brienne travel throughout the next couple of episodes. And I think the reveal is she shows up and hangs them.
Yeah. I like
that's the first time we meet Lady Stoneheart is when she hangs Brienne.
And I was reading to prepare for this, I was reading some of the wiki boards so that I was, you know, on par with you guys. And someone said that there's like a spoiler interview where a bunch of the cast is interviewed and they were all asked what's the number one character they would bring back. And every single one of them said Catelyn. And the other thing is if you reveal Michelle Fairley, like that's the last shot. If it's like a hooded figure, then the last shot is just her face. Like they could film that on the sly so easily. Like they did something very similar in Shameless. I think they could keep that under wraps pretty well. So
yeah. Well, also fingers the last crossed. Episode's title is The Children.
Right.
Which I think that's the thing about Lady Stoneheart that I can't get behind all these people who are saying, oh, they're not going to do it. You know, or there's a lot of people. And I don't know if this was on you guys were talking about this last week or if it was on another one of the many Game of Thrones podcasts I had to watch because I needed a fix last week. There are a lot of people out there who are saying, oh, they're not going to bring back Lady Stoneheart because then people are going to say, well, why can't they just bring back anybody? There's a lot of narrative currency to why she comes back. You know, when she dies, there's this kind of fierce motherly thing that she has right as she dies that she assumes that her children are dead. So when she comes back, it's this that force. You know, obviously there's the Thoros of Myr thing and Beric Dondarrion kind of trying to do right by the Stark line. But there's this force that drives her when she comes back that is revenge for everyone who killed her children. And I think that that's too important of a theme for the show to just ignore, especially as we get back into the, as we get in deeper into the supernatural territory.
I agree. And I guess the opposite way I could do the supernatural thing I was talking about before is if she comes back and provides the vengeance that the audience, beaten down by the end of this season, feels like they need, that's the sort of thing that saves a show from the, you know, season-long review things that are basically just going to talk about how they misstepped a scene and made it a rape up until now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the sort of narrative through line where it's like, you did it, you figured out a way to balance the crazy supernatural because you made us care, you allowed us to become the vengeance that resurrected Lady Stoneheart. That's what I think the show needs to deal with it. So I'm very happy to hear you link it to the title of The Children, because that makes complete sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
As somebody who's just read it as bullet point plots.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I love that. I've never heard that phrase before, and I love it so much. Narrative currency related to that plot. I do. I just think it's very important. And, you know, for people to dismiss it, I think means that that it's not resonating for them, just the way it resonated for me. So, and also what I was going to say about, this idea that anyone can come back. Like, that's, you know, when I was teasing this season and talking about like a game-changing supernatural event and how maybe a lot of people are going to be mad because, it kind of bends the rules. I mean, we've seen it with Beric Dondarrion, but it bends the rules. But I think that's A, necessary to establish what happens with Jon, and B, I don't know, in a world where White Walkers have a huge Fortress of Solitude, like, are we really that precious about supernatural rules anymore, you know?
So. Where we're going, we don't even need roads.
Or rules.
But I also think that it's like, why do the Beric Dondarrion thing if they're not going to do Lady Stoneheart?
Exactly.
Why set that up? Like, it's already established that there is this power that the Red Priests and Priestesses have to bring people back, but it's limited. You know, it's not like an all-out power where they could just bring people back. Like, he doesn't come back. You know, Beric Dondarrion says in the show, every time I come back, it's a little different, you know? So I think it's that, and then the specificity of the way Sansa described the way her mother died, where she's like, they cut her throat through into the river. There's no reason for those details to be in there if you're not bringing this character back. Because that's all the breadcrumbs. They love the breadcrumbs. And I think they're very playful with this supernatural stuff. I feel like it's a great tag at the end of the season to go, hey, remember that person that died? Yeah, she's coming back and she's going to kill everybody. It's going to be great.
I mentioned this somewhere. I want to say it was on the Broken Projector. I almost called it Rejects Radio. The Broken Projector podcast. But that they filmed some behind the scene thing where they were all talking about how sad it was to say goodbye to Michelle Fairley. And I was like, you guys are messing with everyone. I am fairly certain. So
they really enjoy it. You really get the sense that Benioff and Weiss enjoy the sneakiness of it. You know, they kind of enjoy being on the side of the book readers and going, yeah, you guys know what's coming next, don't you? But they also apparently, as of last week, like messing with all of us.
Yeah, that was a weird thing to see this week. And I guess I don't really want to talk about that because I think that author intention is important, but it makes criticism less fun. So I'd much rather talk about the fact that the last 20 minutes of this episode was just like a huge departure and they still felt like they needed to drill in what bad guys are. Did that seem like horribly, like, okay, drinking from the skull I get, raping I get, conversation around the fire I get, but couldn't you just have saved that all for when Bran got drug in, so at least I could be processing my shock, not my horror?
Sure, yeah. I think at that point they were killing time and they were just like, well, this guy's gonna die next episode, so let's make him really bad. They are, this is all part of the discussion about the previous week's episode. There are points where they go for the shock value.
Right.
And that's part of, you know, that's kind of born out of the way the books are. The books are far more nuanced in the way they do that, but the books deliver that emotion. So they're trying to do that in a more compact way So, you know, and sometimes it's a hit and sometimes it's a miss. And I think the previous week it's a miss because they seem to have misinterpreted what's shocking about that. But this week, this is kind of a hit, but they're really just killing time.
Well, I'm going to say it's a miss because I think while the purpose of the scene is to show us that they're evil, what they missed was the stuff they were trying to massage into the actual thematic point of the episode, which is what happens when you break oaths and the difference mm-hmm. between highborn people and lowborn people and how they view oaths. But what happens is I'm not listening to any of the dialogue because literally the subtitles are the girls being raped in the background.
Right.
And so
just the one dude over his shoulder while he's talking is just pumping away. And
just
point, the person I was watching with, who is not a book reader, she just leans over to me and goes, "Just what's that guy doing in the background?" I'm like, "Oh man,
I don't want to tell you, but it's
macrame,
like,
basket weaving."
They're in love.
I don't want to knock them because they, you know, showed evil to evil. I want to knock them because the pretext for why we were there didn't hold up with what they were trying to do with the episode. There's a lot of good stuff in this episode with light. People are on different sides of a central light source, or lights that's disappearing and sort of twilight, or sitting around a fire, and then about mm-hmm. oaths and about highborn and lowborn. And then they brought it all together, and for whatever reason, maybe it's the exact same thing that happened last week, the direction just made me think this was all horrible and I could have been actually listening.
But it's just so weird to me because Michelle MacLaren is so skillful. Like, she's such a skillful director. And the whole, like, the first 40 minutes, I was just admiring everything that she was doing with light, exactly what you're talking about, all of this beauty. And also, I think the writer Brian Cogman is one of their better writers. And to have these two artistic forces create one of the most, you know, hit you over the head with the skull goblet scenes, like, I beggar's belief to me. I don't really understand it. So I'm trying to sort of gloss over it, basically.
I guess middle seasons are where we stumble, especially when we begin to invent out of whole cloth parts of story that we're, I guess, going to just draw out for like one or two more episodes, right?
And that's the tough part about the transition episodes when they're, you know, it's all the early... It's the moving of pieces episode where you start kind of, last week had a lot of that. And this week has a lot of that where they're just trying to get people in the right spot so that they can, you know, kill each other for the end of the season. And so it really does. That's all that scene felt like to me was, okay, they're killing time and they're just trying to get us to. And I didn't really know where they were going with that. At first, when that scene came up, I was like, why are we here?
Right.
Like, we know those guys are douchebags because they killed Mormont.
Right.
And we know that somebody's going to come kill them eventually. And I think the eventuality of it is they need to be there to capture Bran. But it really does go on a little bit too long.
And yeah, it's fine to establish them as evil, but I think we got it way earlier than they gave us credit for. It's possible also, if, you know, our theory is correct, I mean, either you think Cold Hands or some substitute is going to come and kill them all, or John is going to come kill them all. And if John is going to come kill them all and we still want him to be our hero, do they have to be painted as black as they possibly could be? Does it have to be not just men pushed to the breaking point where they commit, God, I can't even think of the word. They mutinize. That's not the verb.
Mutilate?
No, but like... The verb rebel. Of mutiny, they rebel.
Oh, the mutineers?
The mutineers, yeah, but is there not a verb? Or anyway.
I think it's just mutiny. When they
mutiny. When they kill Mormont, you know, they're starving and they're, you know, at the edge of you know, everything. And so maybe we can think, oh, they were pushed to the breaking point and they committed this heinous act. But we have to know that even in their leisure time, they drink from skulls and rape a lot, so that we have to really, really hate them.
We really need to dislike Carl of Ginelli.
Poor Carl Tanner. I love that actor, and this is not doing him any favors. But yeah, so that when Jon comes, and it's like with Joffrey, painting Joffrey so black that when he dies, we can all cheer. Painting these people so black, true. You know, that if Jon comes and kills them, that just makes him look like more of a hero to us, which is what I think this show is really sweating to get us there.
Yeah, I mean, they did really crank it to 11 right at the end of Joffrey. Right. They were just like, he needs to be the worst possible version of Joffrey for the like 5 minutes before he chokes and dies.
Right.
So Which was a delight. It was the best. Yeah. For somebody who doesn't get the nuance because it's television, sigh. But it'll come to me eventually. It'll rise to my level. I am very confused. I am more confused now.
Oh, no.
I had no idea that taking away certainty from people that weren't me would also make me uncertain. It's like, here's I guess the thing. Was what I'm worried about primarily when I see this episode isn't so much how they're rearranging things and what I think is going to happen, because I think the execution's good anyway. I think it's that the stalling that happened in this episode during the points when they diverted from the book, I want to know if this worries you guys, and this is foreshadowing for the first off-book season. It's just going to be a lot of why are we here and why is this so weird?
I mean, maybe it's possible. I think a lot of this has to do with not just the rehabbing of John's character, but the idea of pushing the Battle of Castle Black to episode 9 and making that like the big what the fuck moment of this season, when it's not, right? It shouldn't
Every episode has a big what the fuck moment this season, it seems. Like it's going to.
Right, exactly. And I mean, I think the Oberyn stuff is going to be more emotional, or maybe that's just me because I think Pedro Pascal is the best thing ever. But
also because Oberyn's the best character.
Exactly. Exactly. Ever. But this idea that, you know, Jon gets back to the Castle Black and then the battle happens pretty much immediately, right? And so this concept of pushing it back in 9 episodes, you're like, what do you do with Jon? So stretching that out. But you're right, Dave, that like who knows what else they're going to do in order to create these peaks and valleys, and these narrative peaks and valleys that they feel like they need. You know,
that's what I found interesting about your piece, because it seemed like what you were subtly suggesting is that they're going to react rather than build their own arcs, which is what, I mean, it would make sense now that we're in the middle of a whole bunch of source material. But if their first reaction when they don't know what to do is to sort of comment on things people have told them in bars, it's going to be interesting once we get off the map and all they have is an endpoint and a whole bunch of characters they've, you know, had a half a hand in creating, but maybe depended too much on the books for pacing. And then it's just going to sort of be, I don't know, it has a risk of being this sort of tumble into just like a, and then there were dragon riders.
I don't worry. Go ahead. Go ahead, Joanna.
No, I want you to go ahead.
I don't worry so much about this season. There's so much that has to happen before this season's up that I think this episode's kind of an anomaly. And there was even that quote from Brian Cogman where he's like, this is really one of the hardest episodes to write, because it's just kind of, there's much of it's kind of out on an island. Mm-hmm. So I don't worry about the rest of this season, but I do kind of worry, especially about like the Dany and Marine stuff gets really dry. And, you know, once you get outside this and you get to like Tyrion's journey across the Narrow Sea, that gets a little dry. And what characters do you keep and what characters you don't keep? So I think there's a lot of risk going forward for them, but there's also so much about this story that we still don't know. You know, there's at least 10,000 pages in 2 books that he has to write still, you know, or let's go modestly 20,000 pages the way he writes. There's so much story left that we don't really know where it's going. And I think that last week showed that there is stuff that they're going to show us before the books get there. It's inevitable. So I think that they're not going to have to make a whole lot of stuff up. I think there's going to be so much by the end of it that it's not going to, they're not going to have to worry about filling 7 or 8 seasons.
Yeah. And I mean, even that George R. R. Martin even though he distanced himself from that like rape controversy last week, like they've all said that they've sat down and he's mapped out how it works for them. So it's not right. like they're making shit up, but they're making shit up to the same end that he's making up shit.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, he's pacing to a novel, and we've already seen what happens when you have to take something that's made to be paced for a novel and paced for a TV show. And I'm wondering if that's not a Jenga tower that we're pulling too many blocks out of here at the bottom.
It's entirely possible. And I can see, sure. and it's not just, I mean, all of us who love the books still freely admit that the series peaks at book three and then it's problematic thereon. So even if they were, you know, slavishly faithful to the books, it still wouldn't be as good of a show as it was the first 3.5 seasons, you know?
I think that's what's most exciting about it, really, is that the books really sort of slow down, books 4 and 5, and they will have the freedom to make stuff up. You know, they're going to have to if season 5 is going to be interesting, they're going to have to make up a whole bunch of stuff, or we're going to have to see a bunch of stuff that's not written yet. So I think, to me, that's exciting, because I think I like what they've done. I like all the things they've changed. I like the way they've formulated the show and the way they've developed these characters. So if they get to play a little bit more in their big sandbox, that's kind of interesting to me, because I'd rather be like last week. I'd rather be surprised.
Certainly. I mean, I'm trying to think about book series or that have been adapted into TV shows that have ended differently than the movies. And I'm drawing.
Well, people keep bringing up True Blood, and I never read True Blood. I do still watch the show, but I'm not like really proud of it. So I'm not going to hold it up as like some fine piece of art. But I heard that a lot this week or the last couple days of people being like, oh, this is what happened when HBO got their hands on True Blood. They just destroyed those books. And I'm like, those books? Okay.
You know, I think I know what the issue with True Blood is. My mom has read the True Blood books because this is the world we live in. But the problem with True Blood adapting that is she's written like 20 or 30 books.
Oh, yeah.
It feels like there's just a million of those things. So adapting that's ridiculous. So at some point you just kind of have to break off and go, all right, this is the show. These are the books. You know, it's not like Harry Potter where it's an even number of films. It's an even number of books. Everything's done. It's this clean, pretty thing. You know, Game of Thrones is going to get a little messy here. And I think that's kind of the most interesting thing about it, is that it's been very faithful. Now it's going to get messy. That could be either really great or it could be really terrible.
Yeah. So like 2 weeks ago, Hannibal killed off a character that appears in Red Dragon. And so that could mean that the character's still alive or that we're diverging from the books. But because Hannibal is a prequel to Red Dragon and we have those Hannibal Lecter movies, I'm not feeling like I'm on the tightrope like I'm starting to feel like I'm on with Game of Thrones. It's like, do I trust these guys to start making stuff up if I'm still not exactly sure how much I trust that they're getting the adaptation across in the way that they want?
I think that's a good question, and I think it depends. It is, you know, like Neil is fully on board, which is awesome. I'm a little hesitant, which is, you know, my own thing. And then I think there's enough brilliance in this show and enough, you know, nailing it. And for me, it's the quieter moments that they nail, honestly. Like, I think they think that the big moments, the like big CG shots of Marine and stuff like that are the things that people get really excited about. But for me, it's like Marjorie and Tommen, you know, like those, that stuff is, I think, what they nail so well. You know, but that's my preference, you know, in art in general, I guess.
You're not the only one who appreciated the appearance of Sir Pounce of House Cockwell.
Well, that's the webisodes for this summer. One could only hope.
The Adventures of Sir Pounce.
Yeah, I'd love it.
Of House Cockblock. Absolutely.
You just have one cat run through the sets of Game of Thrones when nobody's paying attention. Get someone to nicely edit it with a narrative. I feel like we should definitely invite Neil back. Neil, if you'd like to join us next week, this has been fantastic.
It has.
Of course.
And then before we wrap up and tell everybody where they can find us on the internet, I would be remiss if there isn't anything specifically about this episode that we forgot to talk about. What's not going to come up again, and then we're going to be like, oh, dang, we didn't talk about Oathbreaker's sword holder. I don't know, probably not.
Well, I'm glad that we didn't talk a lot about rape, honestly. I mean, we talked a little bit about rape. We talked about background rape, but we didn't talk about, like, the rape.
Not this episode, in the episode of the show.
No. I know. That's what I mean. But I wanted to say that I really liked the Brienne and Jamie stuff, as I always do. So that's all I wanted to say. And I was worried that it was going to be completely overshadowed by what happened in the series the week before. And it was flavored by that, but, flavored by rape. But, it was still very well done. So
I would say it was a light rape glaze.
Ooh, like ooh. That sounds like a donut I would guiltily enjoy.
Oh,
I thought they were gonna make Brienne at the beginning of the series. I thought she was gonna be the one that trained Jaime to fight, because then they'd have that little extra moment before they had to say goodbye to each other.
I like they used Bronn stuff.
Yeah, no, it worked out fine.
I think you're just gonna keep Bronn doing that, like fill in that role going forward.
Well, yeah, and in the books, it's Illyn Payne that trains him, and that's the most boring character ever. So,
well, yeah, and someone said that actor has like a terminal disease, which is really sad. But I think no, it is. But more, but they would just recast him because that's what the show does. Sure. I think more than that, it's going to be a more dynamic scene. Because in the books, you can have Jamie in his head be like, or he's actually talking, right, to Illyn Payne and sort of confessing all of his stuff. But yeah, that would be way less dynamic than having him talk to such a great character as Bronn. So,
yeah. I think the only thing that we didn't get a chance to talk about, we touched on Sir Pounce. Clearly, but I do like that they are already being very pronounced about the war. I call it the battle for Tommen between Margaery and Cersei, because that is such a huge storyline going forward as far as the power. I mean, not that any of it matters, because this White Walker thing is going to just come and wipe everybody out anyway. But
in the short term,
the battle for King's Landing and Tommen being this sweet kid that really is going to get, jostled between these two very smart and dangerous women, I think it's a really fun dynamic that goes back to the point that you made earlier, Dave, about the human characters. You know, while we have all this supernatural stuff, we're still going to have a lot of this politicking going on in King's Landing, even after a bunch of Lannisters and Martells die. So
awesome. Yeah, I fell into my own trap. I think last week I was like, who watches this for just the dragons and the boobs? That's so stupid. And then this week I was like, let's talk about the ice zombies. So I guess different strokes every week on Game of Thrones. Neil, it was a pleasure having you. Where could people find more of your work on the internet?
Filmschoolrejects.com, blog of Thrones, if you just search blog of Thrones, or on Twitter at Rejects. That is where I can be found.
I love Neil's Game of Thrones recaps, by the way. They're really funny.
Oh, thank you. I'm flattered. But I have to update the death index next week. Put all my friends through the who dies next. They're all so terribly wrong this year.
That's awesome. I did. Okay, I'll tell you later. Anyway, is it my turn?
Yeah. Tell us who you are, where you're from, where you work.
My name is Joanna Robinson. You can find me every day on vanityfair.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This.
Oh, and I'm Dave Gonzalez. You're listening to this in the Fighting in the War Room feed. It's a podcast I co-host. You can also find more of my work at DA7E, which is my Twitter handle and Latino-review, where I cover superhero movie news, this week Amazing Spider-Man 2, and a lot of stuff about dubstep, strangely. That might be related, but has nothing to do with this podcast. Guys, thank you so much. I think next week I might be out, so if Neil's nice enough to step in for me, I think it might be a Joanna Neil all book
super. It would be my sincere show. Honor.
Boom. We just spoiled our own spoiler podcast. See you next week, guys.